This is the Farming for a Better Climate podcast. Hello and welcome to this Farming for a Better Climate podcast. My name is Seamus Murphy and today I'm joined again by Robert Ramsey. How are things, Robert?
Yeah, good, Seamus. Good to be on again.
The last few weeks we've been looking at the different agricultural sectors and the different things that farmers are doing to reduce emissions and the different kind of push and pull from the current multiple crises we're in, cost of living, energy, all of that kind of stuff. But there's more to the wider agricultural food industry than just what happens on the farm. There's that whole piece beyond the farm gate that's probably going to have been impacted just as much as the farmer has been in terms of the multiple crisis. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so it is very interesting, and it's an area where we are probably, certainly you and I are doing slightly more, and certainly colleagues are doing more after the farm gate, which is exciting because it's a major part of, you know, we're part of my world. The beef and sheep world is about turning grass into protein.
Yeah.
And actually where we've normally worked is in the grass to live animal, but the grass to packet, grass to consumer's plate is the full story. So it's really interesting to pair it out. And what I think is interesting is the agricultural inflation was huge before inflation was really a thing for the consumer. So we were seeing fertilizer prices more than doubled, fuel prices doubled, you know, all our key inputs were way up before the, you know, the rest of society was talking about inflation. So I think farmers were the first ones to know that the inflation, the financial crisis we're in just now, we were the first ones to know it was coming. And we were, it was quite clear that for us to remain in business globally, which isn't an option either, you know, the farmer has to be in business, that would have to be passed on to the consumer. So it's interesting to see where that's gone. So on the supply chain front, the costs of production spiked in farming first, and I think are certainly easing now. So we're probably into 2023, things are looking a good bit better for a lot of the input end of things. But then you look at that now, although that our inflation had to be passed on, we're not going to see a deflation in food price because the inflation we saw is now the energy inflation in the processing end of things. So we've got abattoirs, meat processors, you know, dairy companies, all the processing industries now have huge electricity bills, huge wage bills, and we're seeing that can really getting kicked down the road. So yeah, very, very interesting times, and certainly looking forward to having a good chat about things today.
Yeah, and just kind of expanding on that a bit, I think since I've been working in this area, a lot of farmers have, as an environmental consultant working in an agricultural consultancy, a lot of farmers kind of point out that there is such a disconnect between the consumer understanding what happens on the farm. Do you think that this crisis, or that kind of movement of the inflation from the farm up to the consumer, has raised the awareness of the consumer of the kind of what happens on farm? Or do you think that they're joining the dots there?
Oh, it's difficult. So I think COVID definitely did. So I think in the, you know, initial weeks of COVID, we saw agricultural prices crash across the board. You know, we didn't know what was going to happen. Beef went to £3 a kilo, and, you know, it was a real scary time. And then out of that came almost a new dawn and farming. Farmers had a purpose. We were in an industry that had to keep going. Mm-hmm. And we were an industry that then supermarket shelves became barer, and we were able to fill, you know, we were fulfilling a role to feed the public. And I think we definitely gained an awful lot of positive PR in that area. But we've got to remember, at that point, people had tons of money. You know, people were really probably at that stage would be as well off as they have been in the last, certainly in the last 10 years, that they were at home with the same wage, low costs for everything, and, you know, they had money to spend. So money was burning a hole in their pocket. So they did support local butchers. They did shorten supply chains. They did look towards a story and look towards, you know, the nice idea of keeping the farmer in that farm, because, you know, the emotional bit got people. Mm-hmm. Now, cash is king. So now people are really strapped for cash, and, you know, genuinely struggling to make ends meet. And that's the biggest priority now, is filling a supermarket basket or trolley for as little money as possible. So our story in there has to get, I think it's that people are more interested than they were pre-COVID, but less interested than they were during COVID.
Mm.
And we need to keep our story relevant and keep our story moving with the times, because COVID now, it's not long ago, but the world is dramatically changed again. So our story and our interaction with the public has to change, and we have to adapt what we are doing to fit what they need.
Yeah. I think what's been really interesting for me and some others in the work that we've been doing has been that the attempt to join the dots between what the consumer is receiving and on the supermarket shelf and what the farmer is producing, but we're joining those dots in terms of the emissions associated with it, and to kind of help us unpack where those emissions are coming from beyond the farm gate. We've asked our colleague John Farker, who's a senior consultant with SSE Consulting, to help us with that. John's been working on trying to bridge that gap between the farm emissions and the emissions associated with getting that product to the consumer. Welcome, John.
Morning, whatever time this goes out.
So, John, I suppose in the first instance, where are the big emissions outside of the farm gate? Where's the kind of, for the multiple products, we're kind of talking across that, the spectrum of agriculture in Scotland, where are the kind of the big hitters there in terms of beyond the farm gate?
For most products, generalizing, it's refrigeration. So it's keeping it cold or freezing it. Yeah. I mean, it's different if it's something that's processed and cooked. If it's any cooking involved, you're talking about a ready meal or something like that, it's the cooking. But generally, as a product, a raw product that we'd recognize, refrigeration for most things is probably the overall biggest. Keeping it cold, keeping it stored. Lots of our produce we keep in a cold store for months. So yeah, it's going to the shelves. So that's the kind of probably our biggest emissions post farm gate. Lots of people will, the high profile one is transport.
Mm.
I mean, there are supply chains where that is, but within the UK, that is rarely your highest, and it's generally sometimes not even significant. People can see that. They can see lorries moving and things like that, but we're actually fairly efficient at moving things around. I'm not saying there shouldn't be an effort on that, because it's quite an easy one to reduce, but it isn't in the scheme of the kind of, by the time you get it on your plate, driving it around the country hasn't been the biggest effect. It's usually the storage of it.
And what about kind of the electricity in terms of the actual converting that farm product into a saleable product for a retailer?
Yeah, I mean, if it's a meat product, the abattoirs will be using electrical equipment to cut it up and things like that. Still not as big as the refrigeration. Yeah. So the electricity is being used for the refrigeration to keep things chilled. So in a refrigerated lorry, that still is almost as big as the transport. The knives and the guillotine and all the kind of conveyor belts do use up quite a lot. It depends what we're processing, but in most of our processing plants, we kind of know that it's probably a lot less than half is going on the conveyor belt. Most of it's going in the refrigeration and freezers. So some, it's as low as like 10-20%. So okay. That's why there is a lot of effort on refrigeration. And there's a lot of regulations around it as well.
And is that kind of the same across, we'll say, livestock and arable?
No, well, yeah. So within, obviously, cereals, no, the storage there is your big energy consumption is drying it. The last few years has been quite fortunate, and it's incredibly, unlike refrigeration, one year is not comparable with the other. There's sometimes zero drying. So cereals and most of the drying it, beans, you all of those things.
Most of that drying is done pre-farm gate as well.
That's true.
So it's usually the farmer that undertakes that drying process.
There are, depending on where you are, depending on what you're drying, sometimes they don't let you dry it down very low. So if you're all your malting stuff, they want to keep it high, and they want to do the final drying. But on a dry year, most of it's done in the grain stalls. So it's that's the biggest good. But at least once you've got it dry, though, there's no storage energy. Well, there are some for fans to keep it cool.
In general, how does that actually compare with the farm emissions? Is this where do we stand in terms of the comparison there?
So for meat products, and the different meats are different. So red meat products, everything's different, but your emissions post farm gate are less than 5%.
Okay, well.
But then you go to the poultry, the white meat sector and stuff, then they will be going up towards 10, 20. But almost all meat products, the emissions lie behind the farm gate. But for cereals, it's post farm gate.
John, I think it's worth having that. I don't want to come into a big methane debate here either, but it's also worth, I think, flagging up as a defender of red meat, the type of emission there too. So there is a methane, the biogenic methane story, so the cycling methane, and that doesn't change the fact that the methane that's produced has a warming effect, but it's not a stack effect like the CO2 produced. So post-farm gate, it's all, I think is it a generalization to say it's all fossil fuel-derived emission?
So actually, no, quite a lot from refrigerants.
Ah, okay.
So leaking refrigerants are quite a big chunk of it, and some. So, but yeah, they're mostly fossil fuel. Yeah.
Yeah, none of it's a natural emission, whereas pre-farm, so the pre-farm gate story's more complicated.
Yeah.
The post-farm gate is pretty much like any other emission. It's a CO2 or refrigerant emission.
Yeah, it's all that afterwards. The methane is a very different. NOx is also so your NOx emissions from your soils and things like that, that's same. But methane is a very short-lived gas, which actually represents a good opportunity. Depleting CO2, CN2 lives in the atmosphere for thousands of years. NOx lives for hundreds of years. You've kind of, there's a debate. But let's say 5 to 10 years, the methane's pretty much gone. That the one that was emitted. So if you reduce it, you get a quick change. So it is an opportunity as well as nothing, but it is biogenic. And it's coming from the animal mostly, but it's also coming from manures. There's some bits you can do about this, the manures, the stuff that's coming off your bedding or your slurry pit, but most of it, that animal is going to give off methane.
It's the bit I think we need to get as an industry, again, pre-farm gate, but as an industry, we need to get our story straight that actually, quite often farmers will shout about how methane doesn't last long. It's cyclical, it's this, it's that. There's the same amount of cattle in the world, blah, blah, blah. True story, and I accept all that, and I would engage with all of that. But I think it's very dangerous if we bang that message out to people who are looking, if we're looking to cool the planet.
Yeah.
That you could take that methane story and say, great, awesome. Well, that's a great opportunity. We can do something that will make a positive impact for the next 10 or 20 years and buy us some time. So we need to be, I'm not backing that story.
Yeah.
But we need to make sure the message going out is more grown up than it doesn't last very long.
Yeah, rather than ignoring it, because it is an opportunity. And so especially when it's when it comes to bedding, because especially when you go into the red meat, bedding is responsible for a lot of methane. Whatever the animal, poultry, if they're bedded animals, that is a big chunk of the methane. So that's something that bedding systems are going to be important. And as bedding systems change, and those are, the animal itself is hard to control. Let's ignore the inhibitor question for now. But it is, if we say, well, it's short-lived, bang, we don't need to address it. It's not changing, and it isn't changing. That is true. Methane from agriculture, I should say. There is a bit of evidence from China it's increased a bit, but at the moment it seems to be fairly steady. The ones that is increases is from fracking and all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. From peatlands in the kind of Arctic zone. But agricultural is the same. So people say, oh, we'll ignore it. No, there's an opportunity here, and we have to say, okay, we can help. And that's what I think the message needs to be with the things we can control.
It's crucial that message, I think, is that reduction is what is required, reduction on farms, because there is a risk that someone could say, as kind of Robert indicated, we reduce methane, we can have a huge reduction impact on warming, so let's reduce methane. And we all know what the quickest way to reduce methane would be. So we don't want policies that restrict kind of or reduce livestock numbers, because we know the damage that would cause. But we want farmers to take it on and actively start to reduce their methane emissions and become that bit more efficient. And that's kind of the key to that.
And use the ruminant, which produces methane, manages grass, manages habitat. You know, the whole the story is awesome. And we want to make, as we've all said, we want to make reductions in methane on farms. We don't want to see reductions in numbers of stock or farmers, or, you know, we need to, as an industry, we need to step up to this and make really positive changes, which actually benefit all our pockets as well. But I'm conscious we've gone pre-farm gate again, Seamus, apologies.
Well, I think it's an important one, because we've got to balance pre-farm gate to post-farm gate in this discussion. But with the methane thing, the target is to reduce it per animal, not per farm. That's the key message. Yeah. Reduce it per animal, not per farm. Because otherwise, per farm, it's just not going to work, because you would just... And there are ways of doing that. We all know what those are.
Yeah, it is important to make that distinction between kind of, you know, you are the bulk, we'll say, of the emissions post-farm gate are going to be CO2, and then you will have the refrigerants. And the thing about the refrigerants are there could be a very small proportion of emissions of refrigerants, but their global warming potential can be in the thousands. So we all know, or most people will know now, if they're a livestock farmer, they probably know or have heard that methane has a global warming potential of about 28, which is essentially means 28 times more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. And some of these refrigerants can be thousands of times more potent than CO2. So it's essentially, you know, one ton of this of X refrigerant is emitted would be the equivalent to 1,000 tons of CO2. So that's why the refrigerant story is important. However, it is kind of one of these quick fixes. I don't know, John, is it as simple as I kind of make it out? It's kind of like there are a lot of new refrigerants out there that have a lot lower greenhouse gas global warming potential.
Yeah, I mean, the refrigeration industry's kind of got a clearer path than agriculture, because there's regulations that say what you can, and it's phasing over time. They're phasing out our choices at the moment. So lots of companies are switching to scale. Lots of our refrigeration is actually pre-farm gate, but it's still or in a central group. So I would count like centralized fruit storages. And so even though it might be on a farm, that's post-farm gate. It's beyond the growing stage. Once you're on storage, potato stores would come into that. They have little opportunity, because the choices are CO2. If you want to go zero, or one, it's ammonia or CO2. CO2 technology might come on, but it's an expensive technology to do refrigeration with CO2. Ammonia, it's flammable and it's toxic. So you've got to have measures in place to deal with ammonia. It's not something to be trifled with. When you get an ammonia leak, you'll look like there's some kind of apocalypse going on. You are in full hazmat suits and things like that. So it's not simple, but there is a trajectory. They're dropping from the thousands to the hundreds. That's the first step. And that's an order of magnitude. That's kind of tenfold decrease. The large companies are already switching to ammonia. But I'm not sure that's CO2 has to develop really for the on-farm thing. But the best fix is maintaining a refrigeration system and noting how much so for your big organization, you have to report how much refrigerant gas you fill up every year. Your small organization, you don't have to. But if you're noting it yourself, it's like, okay, because this is expensive stuff. It's really expensive, the refrigerants, and they're going up. They're purposely making them. They're taxing them. So the high ones. So it's like, okay, you don't want to switch out your system. To change refrigerant, most times you've got to kind of change your system.
There's a story in here, though. Like, there's a lot of stuff that's kept. We call it fresh, but it's kept in the state that it was harvested in that it never used to be. So I think the potato is the prime example. Is when we grow a small amount of potatoes at home, and it's, you know, they're stored ambiently, and we eat away, you know, they're just basically for home use and family and friends and things. But those potatoes it's a traditional setup where you've got new potatoes in the spring, and then you come to about maybe August, and you start maybe September, you start peeling potatoes, and by now you're peeling potatoes, and the product has changed a bit with the season, but we're eating perfectly good potatoes. But they don't look like salad potatoes that come out of the ground. So our consumer, you know, all this refrigerant stuff, there are some things that need to be absolutely need to be refrigerated, like with no doubt about it. But there's other things that we refrigerate for our own, so that our diet is like Groundhog Day. You know, why not allow the seasons to impact not necessarily what's in our diet, but what's the stuff that's in our diet looks like? Because the money that's spent, when we hear the potato guys, I mean, the big potato guys are all on £1 million plus electricity bills this year, for keeping something cold that kind of needs to be cold, but I can't see how it's.
Yeah, it's also got a lot bigger because the sprouting inhibitors have been banned and stuff. So this year's huge. Lots of potatoes that were kept at 10 degrees and so they weren't refrigerated over the. They're now down at 2 degrees.
Yeah.
And if you're keeping it to April, you used to keep the fridge. So if you're keeping it to like February, when most potatoes are out the stores, they're at 6 degrees. Or I'm saying most stores now are between 2 and 3 degrees because you have to, if you want to keep it to April or June.
The danger with me talking about this is I don't really know what I'm talking about, but I do know that what your consumer wants is something convenient out of a plastic bag.
Yeah. All year round.
And that's where the farm gate emissions or the post-farm gate emissions, so many of them are dictated by how convenient it is for our consumer.
Yeah. So there is, so blaming a farmer for the UK's eating behaviour is a bit harsh. Yeah.
So agriculture's emissions are the food industry's emissions are dictated by what, you know, somebody wanting to buy salad potatoes in February from Tesco Direct in the centre of Edinburgh. You know, that's not really an agricultural emission.
No. I mean, it is a choice to, and they are stored for a long time. I mean, there are now stores running they're in the summer. That's unheard of. Mm-hmm. Potato stores are always empty in the summer. Doors open. When I grew up, they were, but it's like they are extending. And it is that thing. And it's like the UK potato is in demand by the customer, which is great. But UK potato in demand in July, June, in the spring, that's a bit tricky.
And I don't think the experience of the consumer would make it any less in demand.
Right. No, yeah.
I don't know, but I think there's an awful lot of process there that's down to fashion trends rather than necessity.
And change of fruit. Let's say for fruits, the more exotic fruits, they don't store as well as our traditional apples and pears and things like that. Like, the harder fruits stored longer, obviously, without than the soft fruits, and extending the season of even growing them. That's also another trend.
Yeah.
Let's keep to this vein here, and we've kind of talked about some of the processing and the transport that's associated. But let's say we have our steak cut, or our whiskey in the
let's have both. That sounds like a good night.
Well, both of these things now, they need to be packaged and packaged in such a way that they're attractive to the consumer. What's the emissions associated with that side of things?
That's a packaging, especially. It's all absolute numbers. It's the same whether it's a steak or blueberries or whatever it is. They're pretty much, depending on the choice of packaging, it's the percentage, and people look at the percentages. In fruit sector, they've got a huge concentration. I mean, it's a specialist thing, looking at packaging. Packaging can be half your emissions with the wrong type of packagings. But for the extender, it'll be a small percentage, but the absolute number is big. It's that plastics, we all know, it's high emitting, and it can be, especially on lightweight products that are in quite big packaging. So fruit salads, very high proportion of their thing, because you've got 100 grams of salad in 10, 15, 20 grams of packaging. But a meat might be in 20 grams of packaging, but it's a kilo of it. And it's an easy one to address. In some cases, there are hygiene issues, but there is a big choice. And they are all looking at, all the processes are looking at packaging.
Yeah. There's a danger of looking at one metric on packaging as well, because we know plastic is, you look at the sea, you go to the beach, you watch Blue Planet, or was it Blue Planet 2 that really opened our eyes to it? And what a revolution since then. You know, since, what would that be, 5 years ago, 7 years ago, something like that, David Attenborough did an amazing documentary series that fully changed the face of packaging and people's view on plastic. But we did, at that stage, see a lot of the smaller dairy companies, so that the high-end dairy guys moved away from plastic bottles back to glass, which consumers liked. It's a nice traditional daily delivery in a glass bottle. The carbon footprint of producing a glass bottle and washing and reusing a glass bottle is higher than producing a plastic bottle and binning it and starting getting a new one. But the environmental benefit, the big picture, is much better. So the carbon story is one thing, but we're not flinging. Well, even if we did throw these glass bottles in the sea, they're pretty inert. It's not that big a deal. But please don't fling them in the sea. But the plastic story is I think it's probably the biggest disgrace that we've, as a species, come. You know, the longest term impact we've had. Once plastic will be here, once we are not.
That's the thing, is when, again, looking at carbon in isolation is the dangerous thing to do. There are some, it depends what sector you're in and how long they last, but glass can be better than plastic, and it depends on the plastic and all these sorts of things. But it's again, if you went carbon, we're going to go into plastic, and especially those plastics that the milk bottle's made out of, they like going into microplastics.
The dairy guys, when they started off, sorry, pre-farm gate tangent again, but the dairy guys, when they started off down the route of genetic selection and things in the 80s, they chased milk big time. Our understanding of genetics was pretty limited at that stage too, but they chased one trait, and they got one trait. They got loads of milk, and a pretty significant issue with high yielding dairy breeds from a welfare perspective, really, you know, struggling to keep these animals alive or with a good standard of living. Or good welfare standards. Once we opened our eyes and realised that all these other non-performance traits were important, we were selecting for them and milk, and now we've got a much better animal and more milk. So I think that's where we look at climate change is totally different to that, but it's the same principle. If we focus purely, if we purely focus on carbon, we're going to get a carbon reduction and massive unintended consequences. Yeah. But if we open our eyes and you know, take the blinkers off here and drive for the carbon thing with other key things in mind.
I mean, generally, when we're kind of looking at carbon kind of mitigation plans, the current metric, so people use the word life cycle, LCA, as the same as a carbon footprint. Not really true. An LCA includes water, natural capital, emissions to the air, like particulates, so things that aren't to do with carbon. But that's why we've got to, so when we're looking at carbon mitigation, we've got to, okay, right, what's the effect on the rivers? What's the effect on biodiversity? Things like hill, especially kind of with hill farming and upland farming. And there is always got to be, it's more of a kind of a, it's not scale. It's just like, is it bad or is it good or is it neutral? Those sorts of things. But you've got to look at it, every measure, and that's every individual measure is assessed against that. Typically at the moment, it's water, air quality, and biodiversity issues. But there are, then you could think, okay, but when it's dead, you've got to go, okay, animal welfare is one. When it's to do with animals, there's also labor. Times you, farmers, no farmers are sitting doing nothing at any point. No farm would say, oh, I haven't got enough people to help me out, or I've got too many people helping me out. So you've got to think, okay, that's the standard way to look at it. So you've got to look at one measure, it might be your primary, but there's seven other things you're considering at the same time.
Yeah.
And that's what I think, I would hope, certainly within our organization, what people do, but it can be organizations that don't know about agriculture. They're saying, yeah, do this. It's like, you can't. You've got 25 people on a farm to do that. And look at it nicely. Oh, yeah, but the water quality, you're going to have loads of runoff into your water courses. These things, you can't look at it in isolation.
And just going back to, trying to take back it to the packaging kind of story. You mentioned, John, that most companies that you've been working with recently are kind of already looking at their packaging and seeing how they can improve it. What are they looking at doing here? Is this moving from plastic to paper? We've seen a lot of that with some like plastic bags and stuff in with retailers, or is it going to moving from virgin plastic to recycled?
Typically, the first step, it depends on what you're packaging how likely it's going to give off moisture and things. I don't know that much about packaging. There are, and the products are getting better. So the paper-based products, paper is kind of good, but it's good if it comes from the right place. You've got recycled plastic. It depends what sort of plastic you're using. Films are quite tricky. So solid plastics are nice and easy. Films, those are harder to do. Looking at fiber-based products, be it cellulose, grass, bamboo, wood. Again, those are looked at, but recycled ones are then even better. These are kind of, there's a hierarchy, but you can't use all of them at the moment because then you've got to put a coating on it, and is the coating worse than the actual film? So first thing to look at is just changing the type. Do I need a crate underneath my tomatoes? Do I need a things like that. So just reducing the amount is the first look at, but packaging is a complex one. It's a very complex one, depending on what breathability they have. But typically, they're looking at recycled, which is that's the hierarchy. It's like reduce, reuse, can't really reuse it, and then recycling. So you kind of recycle materials. There's energy involved in that, but they are definitely better than a lot better.
I noticed that. Christmas, I'm not sure if we can do brand names, but we'll see Quality Street. So we had obviously there's the job I'm in, you get a basically I got a box of sweeties from a client, and Quality Street opened it up, and it was the packaging has changed completely. And you look in, and it used to be wow, like bright and shiny, almost like a treasure chest. Yeah. And now it's all just a bit dull and a bit it's funny how it's changing, but I think most people would look in that tub and think, well, that's different, but it's a positive, it's a good, we know why it's different. All that shiny, you know, metallic looking plastic.
Well, ironically enough, theirs was actually, I think, high starch. Bizarrely, they'd switched. but because people look like plastic, I think so. I'm not sure, because I remember you can kind of like melt it with water. You can dissolve it. The old ones.
The old stuff, right?
Yeah, well, the recent old stuff. Old, it would have been plastic. The foil's not great. The foil's the one that's the big carbon. It's not the plastic. So they've got rid of the foil. That's the big change. But the foil needed to protect the starchy plastic. I think it was that, or an oil-based one. Because you can put, we used to put them on the table and soak them in them to make all the table, which my parents obviously loved. loads of multicolours. But we've really gone brand naming now. But yeah, that will change, yeah. The reason they changed it is because the plastic looks bad, because people don't like plastic. So they've gone away from that.
But if you went back 10 years, you would open that tub and go, oh dear, what's happening? This is terrible. And now you look at it and think, you know, good. Yeah. This is progress.
Yeah.
Still a big plastic tub, right enough.
Yeah, true.
It's interesting. It is kind of interesting as well, though, that move towards predominantly recycled plastics is the way things are going. And I know from my experience, it's not always very straightforward as a consumer to ensure that you can recycle all of the products that you receive. So it is kind of, I suppose it is again, it's coming back to this, some of it has been put back on the consumer to ensure that, I suppose that's where, if the consumer decides they don't want to recycle the plastic, then there is going to be a limited quantity of recycled plastic available for processors to use, I assume. But it's just one of these kind of.
But that's also the problem we've got across the UK is what is recycled in depends on your local authority. Everyone, can go, you know, if you visit someone else, like, what do I put in the recycling bin? Some you put glass, some you can put rigid plastic, some you put all plastic, some you put paper, some you can't put paper. That's what shouldn't be allowed, I think. It's like, let's take them all.
Yeah.
You're never going to get people in the mindset of collecting if they've got to make really tricky decision on what they put in that recycling bin.
Yeah. And you just wonder whether so local authorities have budgets, and that's a big constraint. So they do it at source. So the consumer recycles what they want to and what they consider appropriate to recycle. But surely the right thing to do here is to separate centrally and recycle everything.
Yeah. I mean, you've got the two extremes. So that's the kind of like, I think I'm right on this one. German model is you put everything in the bin. If it's not foodie waste and it's sorted centrally, everything's recycled. Then you've got the Dutch model where you've got 28 bins and you get fined if something's in the wrong bin. So there's like this, and you've got these two approaches. I don't know which one is better and which one kind of was more effective, but
the German model sounds better to me.
Yeah, anyway. For me, I like
anything
that one.
That avoids a fine is.
But but what ends up with the best result? I have no idea.
Yeah.
It's the fact that plastics is a tricky one. So technically, most things you're only meant to put in basically milk bottles and those thick plastics, that shampoo and those sorts of things. Every other plastic, film shouldn't be in there. But it's films and stuff. I know how to, but lots of them could be compressed and made into the plastic fence posts. I mean, I remember there was a German farmer who made all of his fence posts out of just the extruded plastics. They were just, because they're not structural. If you snapped, it didn't really matter. But yeah, there's no sign of rotting. I think they've got a sheath on the bottom where they go in the ground. But yeah, not all plastics have to be made back into a bottle. And anyway, we've kind of dug it, but it's not all packaging. The opportunity to recycle, and what would be great, interesting, is someone in the recycling centre, are we running out of, if you want to buy recycled plastic, are we running out of it? I have no idea.
It kind of shows, though, so now we've talked about pre-farm gate emissions for years, and I think farmers generally have a pretty good handle on the fact what the expectation on them is to be as efficient as possible and produce as much stuff for as little input, how efficient can we be? We then go beyond the farm gate and we see how complicated. The whole, there's so many people, so many factors, so many other stuff comes in post farm gate. And what I wondered, Seamus, you used the analogy of joining the dots earlier on, and I'm really coming round to the idea that the less dots in the system, the easier the thing is to manage. And actually these shorter supply chains, and actually that suits high value livestock production as well, or high value anything production, is shorten the supply chain and, you know, have less links in the chain and more of a relationship with your consumer.
Yeah. I think that's the way thing has to go, to be honest. For the moment, I think the best thing in terms of the way we look at emissions, I think the best thing, the best approach is to look at the farm gate, or the farm gate has the boundary, and we look before the farm gate and beyond the farm gate, because I think as we've kind of highlighted here, both sides of that gate are extremely complex, and both sides of that gate need different solutions to solve the multiple problems to bring about emissions reduction and achieve what we all want to achieve, which is a more sustainable food system. If a farmer agrees with you, Robert, and actually wants to start that conversation beyond the farm gate and try and kind of shorten that supply chain or become more engaged with not only the processor, but the retailer, and then eventually the consumer. I know, John, that some of the work that we've been doing, we've been seeing that, and that's been kind of pushed from the retailer looking back down the supply chain. But is there a place for the farmer to stand up and say, I'm open to change, I'm open to engagement with the retailer? Or are we some way off that at the moment?
There is, depends what sector you're in. Again, it's some are more closely linked to their, maybe not the retailer, that there's a processor involved. Dairy's the same. It's like they're going by the milk companies. They quickly get the messages. And also all of the retailers have a direct engagement farming group. So that, whatever it is with each retailer, they call it different things. They have, not with all of their suppliers, but they have a direct engagement. So that has been increasing over the last 10 years. The retailers have been, okay, with the involvement of the processors, so the meat sector, the abattoirs and stuff, it is increasing. There are certain sectors that aren't. So if you are a sector that's not selling to a processor, you are very removed. And that would need that needs the farmer to say, hang on, I want some information about. So the breeder stores, people are breeding animals and not selling them into the processors. Those in whichever sector, the pig, they don't know how their animals are performing or what the requirements are. That is from the farmer needs to, okay, I mean, I want to do that. I would say if you are selling to a processor, you are already feeling maybe negatively the pressure from a retailer, but or you're engaging positively. Like, okay, this is what we need to do. And the ones I've been working with, it's always been very positive. Okay, this is what we need to do. This is what's realistic. The retailers, there are people in the retailers who completely understand farming. And they're the people who aren't being naive or putting too much impossible measures upon the farming sector. So I'd say I think they are already engaging. It's the messages. There is a fear. I think they don't need to do the fear thing. Like, oh, I don't want to be ranked X against Y against all the other farms. It's like, okay, am I scored on this? Will I have a penalty if I don't meet it? Carbon measurements are too variable and different methods for that to happen. It is just, it's the trend. It's not the number, it's the trend. So it's, are you reducing? Are you increasing? That's all the retailers are looking for, is to reduce. The number doesn't matter. From 2023, 2024, are you more or less? There's other things that can explain that. Obviously, weather, if you're a cereal producer, or droughts, you've got no feed for your animals, you have to import it. The things that you can control, It's like, are they going in the right thing? That's what the retailers are looking for. So don't be scared of engagement with the retailers or the processes.
I would actually add to that. So I totally take your point, John, but I think if you're a farmer who's really wanting to engage, where we're at now, so we've got a small number of multinational processors and a small number of multinational retailers, massive businesses. The right person to engage with is the consumer. So if you're the farmer, tell your story. So some of the best, most successful people we are dealing with at the farmer end at the moment are those that are telling a true story. Now that has to be a watertight, good story. But tell your story to someone that really wants to hear it, and then find someone in the middle who can facilitate it. There's lots of small processors, small retailers and things that can make things happen down the line. But I think engagement should be with the person that really matters at the other end as a consumer, rather than a big company in the middle.
No, that's actually, yeah, that's... makes it a lot easier, as in to sell it to a big company in the middle or a small company or the intermediaries.
But we do need, the industry's built on selling commodities to big companies, so that there's nothing wrong with that. Or there are things wrong with that at times, but that's going to happen. But if you've got a real interest in engaging with someone in the supply chain, engage with the person at the far end with the money.
Mm. Right, I think we'll leave it there. Thanks very much, Robert and John, for joining us. For more information on the topics that we touched on today, please visit the Farming for a Better Climate podcast. Thanks and goodbye.